Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos FP's Economics Podcast. Every week, we take a couple data points, use them to try to explain the world. I'm Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor with you in Berlin, Germany. As always, Adam Tooze, FP's economics columnist and Columbia University professor, is with us in New York. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
So, in the second half of the show, we wanted to continue our periodic series on the world's various countries with a look at the economy of Tajikistan. Tajikistan obviously was in the news recently, given the terror attacks in Russia, which were perpetrated by four Tajiks. We thought that could be a good reason to take a closer look at Tajikistan's economy. But first, we wanted to address another economic story, one based in the U.S., and the data point there is $3 billion. That is the estimate, one estimate, the range is anywhere from 1 to 5 billion, give or take, of what it will cost to replace the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which collapsed in spectacular fashion last week after a container ship collided with it.
They've taken some major steps towards reopening the city's port after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. Workers have begun cutting the bridge.
Their attention towards clearing the debris from the Baltimore Bridge collapse after authorities paused search efforts for four people who are presumed dead there. The Navy says it's mobilizing
barges. First look at the Francis Scott Key Bridge at the bottom of the Patapsco River there in Baltimore. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers released these sonar images of that bridge debris there. They say it's buried in about...
The spectacle of its collapse has been followed by various kinds of standstill. The port of Baltimore, over which the bridge spanned, is closed indefinitely. What had been a major traffic artery over the bridge along the eastern seaboard of the U.S. has been diverted to other busy roads. The talk of replacing the bridge is caught up in politics. The talk of insurance payments is caught up in the early stages of litigation. So anyway, we thought we'd take a look at the various economic aspects of this disaster in the city of Baltimore. And to start off, Adam, you know, I've been reading about the ways that maritime law come into play in determining liability for this bridge disaster, and even sort of historical aspects of maritime law. And I'm curious if you could, describe what role that specific branch of law plays right now in figuring out the economic effects.
Yeah, it's really surprising because I think one's tempted to think of the sea or the water as a sort of lawless space. You know, we've done episodes about pirates and that kind of thing. And in fact, it turns out to be a domain of really ancient law. I mean, when you think about it, it's perhaps not surprising because, you know, thousands of years ago, in fact, until quite recently, the sea and the water were the main way of moving goods around the world, the only efficient way of doing so. And so folks had to come up with various types of legal regulation to handle that. And there are parts of the maritime code, apparently, which date all the way back to the Phoenician period. There's a principle of general averaging, where if you lose part of a cargo, all of the folks who have cargo on the ship end up carrying part of the cost, that apparently came out of, you know, ancient roads 3,000 years ago. The principle that's at stake, I think, in Baltimore, I'm by no means obviously a legal expert, but the principle that I gather is at stake is old, but more recent than that, and it dates to 1851, and it's basically a notion of a limited liability. And that's one of the great legal innovations of the 19th century legal system. And it's a key driver of commercial activity because it means that you can put money into an enterprise and end up capping your losses in the case that things go really badly wrong. And obviously, in the event of a maritime disaster, they do. And in 1851, the US introduced a limitation of liability that was specifically designed to make US merchant marines more competitive with their British rivals, and it caps the liability in the case of a maritime disaster to essentially, as far as I understand it, the value of the surviving bits of the boat. It's most bizarre. Apparently, this principle was applied in the Titanic disaster, and they ended up claiming that they were liable only for the value of the remaining lifeboats and their freight. It's actually insane. So apparently, the White Star Line was faced with damage claims up to $16 million and only ended up paying $664,000 worth in damages. That is the principle which Grace Ocean Private have immediately invoked in relation to the Dali that crashed into the bridge in Baltimore. And so this isn't the end of the story, obviously. This is just the beginning of what will then be an absolutely gigantic legal proceedings. Apparently, they're trying to aim to cap their liabilities at something like double-digit millions, you know, somewhere in the range of, I think they're claiming to try and cap them at $43 million. Maybe the value of the vessel itself is closer to $90 million. As you're saying, the claims calculated in the billions, the loss of life, the killing of the construction workers on the bridge could unleash claims in the hundreds of millions alone, let alone damages to the Baltimore economy and the cost of the bridge itself. So if this legal principle holds, it's a remarkably significant shield, and it then places the emphasis on other sources of redress, which could be insurers, for instance.
I mean, if those are really the limits, it's remarkable that boats aren't more reckless in the U.S. I mean, I don't know if that's measurable, if there are more accidents or something, if they're really protected to that extent.
I don't think you want to be in the middle of a legal dispute like this. I think you invoke only if you're in really serious trouble.
We all make our calculations.
This moral hazard argument is always like, you know, sure, you've got insurance.
Well, it's
for
not
a car
the owner
accident,
of the company on the boat. I mean, you know, or like it's not, you know, but you know, I could imagine them saying, well, you know, all things being equal, you know, cut some corners or something. But yeah, you mentioned insurance, and I guess I do want to dig into exactly how that would work. You know, I've been reading about how reinsurers specifically are going to be on the hook here for any ultimate insurance payouts. And I'm curious, what exactly does that mean in this context? I mean, how does reinsurance work at all? And I guess in this specific case, who exactly gets the money anyway? I mean, who is the ultimate claimant here?
Well, the city sues the shipping line, and the shipping line is insured up to apparently about $3 billion. And it's insured by way of the Lloyd's market, which is the, you know, high-end commercial insurance place where you go if you want to cover really big risks, and particularly maritime risks. And so you have a syndicate, essentially, a reinsurance pool that covers it. In this case, it's the Britannia P&I Club. One of about a dozen protection and indemnity clubs that cover goods and ships that make the world economy work. They're on the hook for about $3.1 billion. That group is led by AXA, the French insurer, and they manage funds from about 80 insurance companies. And so the risk is spread outwards, right? I mean, the way this works is that investors are looking for slices of risk with certain return profiles. And buying, you know, if you're sufficiently liquid and sufficiently large, what you want is exotic profiles of risk and return. And insuring big cargo ships gives you that possibility. But on the other hand, you don't want to be wiped out by a single loss. So you buy slices of it. And this structure of pools managed by, you know, heavy hitting players like AXA allows 80 insurance funds and investors to take a slice of this risk, and the attendant, you know, normally, of course, you just pocket the premiums and walk away, and there's no cost. And then when things go bad, what you do is hope to spread it across many different players. So in this case, it would be losses running into the tens, in the very worst case, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars, which are not going to really do crippling damage to any of the players here. That this is a very big loss by maritime standards. The figures, you know, if it does end up in the $3 to $4 billion range, it will be the biggest single maritime loss ever. The bridge apparently is insured by the state of Maryland with Chubb, you know, the security firm, who also have an insurance branch, and that cover is for hundreds of millions of dollars. So if the bridge ends up costing $1 billion plus to rebuild, there's a gap there, and that's where the legal action will start.
Okay, so even if it is in the level of multiple billions, because it's spread out over many insurers in this kind of reinsurance setup, they can absorb the hit. I mean, like, yes. it's big enough, the pool.
This is what this system is designed to absorb. This is an extremely large claim, individual claim, but it's exactly the sort of thing the system is designed to absorb.
So to turn attention to the city of Baltimore itself, you know, this is a city that doesn't always get international attention. And I'm curious, how economically significant is a city like Baltimore? I mean, what role does this port play for the United States as a whole? And, you know, even how important was the traffic artery that passed over the bridge? Does that have, you know, measurable economic effects on the country?
Historically, Baltimore was a very important port city. It's one of the, you know, early and most rapidly developing cities of colonial American times. It remains a significant city, though one in profound decline. Baltimore most commonly features in international news these days as the backdrop to stories about American urban crisis. And if you've had the chance to visit, as I have recently, it hasn't made much progress since the days of The Wire, which was famously filmed there on you know, the actual streets of the city. It's a pretty rough deindustrialized town, even by the standards of the American East Coast. By now, listeners actually complain about my rough take on the Amtrak corridor, but hell, I thought like I was there only a few weeks ago, and it's disturbing how poor the city is compared to the wealth all around it, of course, because the zones in the proximity of DC are some of the wealthiest and most affluent parts of the United States. The port itself is the ninth most important port in the United States. It's significant above all for particular cargoes, and because it's close to the southern non-union auto manufacturing hub, in which European and Japanese and Korean manufacturers are significant, it's one of the largest ports for the transshipment, both the import and export of vehicles from the United States. And so that's, I think, its principal significance. It's, in fact, the first most significant port in the United States for the movement of cars and light trucks. Several of the terminals to which those very heavy cargo ships connect have not actually been affected. So BMW, I think, has said that it will be able to continue. BMW's Spartanburg plant is one of the biggest in its global system of production. That doesn't seem to be affected. It's also a major port for sugar imports. Domino's, the sugar refinery, one of the most common sugar brands in the United States, operates out of Baltimore, and its logistics will be somewhat interrupted. But Baltimore is not an indispensable node in the East Coast port system, and what will happen is that cargoes will be redeployed to other cities. It receives about 1.5 really big container ships a day, so 3 every 2 days. It's not an intensely busy port compared to some of the others, compared to LA or something like that. And so what will happen is simply a redirection of traffic. In terms of the local economy, it's important. About 15,000 jobs directly depend on the port. I don't think we're in an apocalyptic scenario where all of those disappear at a stroke, which would be a disastrous blow for an already weak city economy. But they're certainly under pressure. The bridge itself is not a major traffic artery. It's significant for Baltimore, but it's not as though this was a major line. So that's the story from that side.
Yeah. Okay. So from the way you're describing this, it sounds like the shipping economy as a whole can adjust to the disappearance of a single port like this. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable fact about how shipping works in general.
Yes, I mean, at this point it can. We're not in the ultra-stretched circumstances in the supply chain that we were in the immediate aftermath of COVID. Philadelphia, Wilmington, Delaware, Savannah, Jacksonville, Charleston all have surplus capacity that could absorb at least some of the traffic in and out of Baltimore. And you're looking for a berth for one big ship a day, maybe 3 every 2 days. So yes, this is a supply chain that can be redistributed. We're lucky in that sense.
So finally, I wanted to turn to the question of rebuilding this bridge and, you know, the politics involved in that. I mean, as the insurance questions are getting sorted out, President Biden has actually already said the federal government will cover the costs to rebuild a bridge. Obviously, that would have to be worked out with Congress, and there are open questions there. But I wanted to ask whether there are sort of real constraints economically on the availability of steel for a bridge, or, you know, I-beams as just a specific kind of part that would be needed, or frankly, of construction crews to build a bridge in timely fashion. I mean, will they have to circumvent planning regulations even to get this done quickly in the way that Biden seems to be promising? And if all those constraints can be overcome pretty easily, why don't we always build infrastructure like this? I mean, it seems like we're always talking about how slow and expensive these projects are. It seems we can overcome them in response to crises. Then, why don't we just do it all the time like this?
I mean, this is this question that was raised, and there's one that we should maybe come back to as a more general topic about, you know, whether or not America is still capable of building big things on anything like a timely fashion. And it's certainly true that projects, really very modest infrastructure projects like minor extensions of the New York subway system, cost astronomic amounts per mile and take, you know, the best part of a decade to complete a few additional stops in a city that already has a subway system, when you compare that with the rate of infrastructure construction, not just in Asia, but in fact in Europe. You know, Spanish cities have built subway systems at a fraction of the cost. It raises all of these questions. Biden is obviously determined to show a strong hand here and step up. As you say, several folks in Congress are up in arms about the fact that he's promising that the federal government should fix a bridge, which is of not of strategic value to the national transport system. Clearing the port and opening it up is a significant priority, but rebuilding this particular bridge, it's hard to justify in those terms. And the costs could be big. It really depends how you do it. If you rely on the existing pillars in the water, which are clearly not really, you know, as widely spaced as you'd hoped, and rely on a structure in which each individual part of the bridge depends on all the other parts of the bridge to hold the whole bridge up. Some engineering experts think you might be able to get away with a sum of, you know, $500 million, less than $1 billion. If one were to rebuild the bridge on the scale of the famous Cuomo Bridge in New York, the Tappan Zee Bridge, you're talking about costs scaled up of billions to $3 billion, potentially, depending on inflation. I think we shouldn't exaggerate the scale of the supply and material needs here. This is one modestly sized bridge that will require a certain amount of I-beam steel, and there are shortages of steel again in various spots. But, you know, there's orders of magnitude here, and this is a relatively modest scale of demand. If America were truly to go about trying to reconstruct all of the bridges in the country that are in a poor state, and famously, you know, a very substantial minority of America's bridges are in a parlous state and have been under-maintained for decades, there might be a more serious pressure here on costs and the skilled labor that are necessary. But I think one shouldn't exaggerate this. And there is a politics here of emergency and of emergency rhetoric, which suits an election year. And of course, it's good for the president to be seen. I'm not doubting his bona fides and sincerity in wanting to help. But there's obviously there's a story to be sold here of an activist president who, when it comes to big steel structures, is, you know, on the scene promptly and going to rebuild them with good, solid American labor doing the work. That, I think, you know, is certainly the optic which they're keen on at this moment. How long it in fact takes and whether it makes sense to cut corners on permitting and so on for a project like this, I think is an open question. Minnesota had a bridge collapse, which was much larger and much more important because it sat on the key traffic artery. And that was done in, you know, less than a decade, in a matter of a year or two. And so I think that will be the timescale that you would hope this project would be expedited to.
Yeah, it sounds like they should not get the construction crews from the New York subway.
No disrespect to them, but yes. Bridges may also not be their bridges may not be their may not be their thing anyway.
Exactly.
This kind of bridge.
Anyway, we will take a break here for now, but be back in a second to talk about Tajikistan. So stick with us.
Hi, ones and twos listeners, Rob Sachs here. I'm one of the show's producers, and I'm here to tell you a little bit more about one of our sponsors, BetterHelp. So springtime is here, and if you're like me, you're ready to get out and hang out with some friends and family a little bit more. But sometimes going out can get a bit overwhelming, especially if your social battery is feeling drained. If this is the case, therapy can be a great way to help keep your social battery well charged. Having someone who can assess your concerns and give you perspective can make all the difference in the world and give the boost you need to feel mentally prepared to go out and be your best self. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you gotta do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched up with a licensed therapist, and you can swap therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/onestwos, that's T-O-O-Z-E twos, today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/onestwos.
Hey, it's Cameron here. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I've got the podcast for you. Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast features great guests like Sami Khoury, head of the Canadian Government Center for Cybersecurity, and Gulsana Mamadieva of the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine. Each episode explores the lessons of digital transformation from leaders all around the world. Head over to aka.ms/public sector future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts. Hi, and welcome back. Our next data point, coincidentally, happens to also be $3 billion. That is the approximate value of the remittances that are sent every year from Russia by Tajik migrants to their home country. You know, that's an expression of the historical relationship between the two countries. Tajikistan was a part of the Soviet Union, of course. It's also an expression of Tajikistan's economic dysfunction. Those remittances are a critical part of the Tajik economy these days, which is one of the world's poorest. So that intertwined historical and economic relationship became twisted in brutal fashion last week when four Tajik terrorists, as I mentioned, killed more than 100 people attending a concert in Moscow. So yeah, we thought we would use this as an opportunity to take a closer look at the Tajik economy. So Adam, I guess one thing I noticed is that Tajikistan, you know, even compared to its direct neighbors, which were also former parts of the Soviet Union, you know, the proverbial stans, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan really is among the poorest, if not the poorest. And I'm curious, was that always the case? Was it really always the poorest of the Central Asian stans? Or, you know, is its divergence really a more recent phenomenon?
It's a fascinating question. So just for perspective, yes, amongst the Central Asian republics, Uzbekistan is the largest with a population of 35 million and the GDP in the $9,000 to $10,000 per capita in purchasing power parity adjusted dollars. Kazakhstan comes next, which is oil and gas rich and is a population of 20 million. And then Tajikistan trails in at 10 million population and the GDP per capita, which depending on how you measure it, some people rate it as low as Haiti. In other data, it looks like $2,000 to $3,000 per capita in purchasing power parity terms. By any standard is poor. And it's, as far as we can judge, its GDP per capita has not progressed. I think this is really the disastrous thing for Tajikistan, is that its GDP per capita is now lower probably than it was in the late 1980s. So it's one of the real failures. Kyrgyzstan is in a similar position. And the tragedy for Tajikistan is that this is absolutely not its long historic role in the region. It's at a strategic point in the Silk Road, and for millennia, or really the last millennium, Tajiks, obviously not the modern state of Tajikistan, but Tajiks were the elite, and they're Persian-speaking, a great people of culture and commerce. Mm-hmm. The famous medieval polymath Avicenna was an ethnic Tajik, as was the Sufi poet Rumi. So through to the 19th century, Tajiks, who were spread across the territory of what is now Afghanistan and Uzbekistan, as well as modern Tajikistan, there's probably as many people of Tajik ethnic background and cultural heritage in Afghanistan as there are in modern day Tajikistan. And though this is hotly disputed, many claim there is a similarly large group. So about 10 million in Uzbekistan, 10 in Tajikistan itself, and roughly 10 in Afghanistan. This sprawling ethnic group found itself really on the losing side of history in the late 19th century, essentially because first the Russian Empire and then the Soviet Union preferred to collaborate with and work with Turkic and ultimately Uzbek ethnic groups and cultural groups. And so modern Uzbekistan and Tajikistan were formed in the Soviet Union in the 1920s, and the great cultural centers of Tajikistan were allocated to Uzbekistan. So Samarkand and Bukhara end up allocated to Uzbekistan, not modern-day Tajikistan, even though culturally and ethnically speaking, certainly at the beginning of the 20th century, they were solidly Tajik. And in the Soviet Union, the Tajikistan then becomes really the most backward of the socialist Soviet socialist republics. It has the highest birth rate, very low agricultural productivity. It becomes the object of repeated Soviet efforts at industrialization and the development of agro-industry, which have the effect of building out a heavy reliance on aluminium and cotton, which remain dominant in the formal economy of Tajikistan all the way down to the present day. And then the disasters of Tajikistan's modern history are compounded in the early 1990s by a brutal civil war that raged between 1992 and 1997, cost tens of thousands, some would say 100,000 lives, displaced a large part of the population. And that civil war was not brought to an end until 1997, with a bargain presided over by the dominant figure in Tajik politics all the way down to the present day, Rahmon Emomali Rahmon, who has been the power broker and is widely seen to have presided in the 90s over the formation of something like a narco state, with Tajikistan playing a pivotal role in the then booming traffic in opioids, opium, heroin out of Afghanistan. So that's the point really where I think many people think that Tajikistan fundamentally diverged, for instance, from Uzbekistan, where we see a much more concerted, very brutal, coercive, authoritarian consolidation of power around the Uzbek state, whereas Tajikistan teeters on the edge of really becoming a failed, impoverished backwater of the post-Soviet era.
So obviously, Tajikistan has a problem with terrorism today. Those terrorists in Moscow last week are not a sole occurrence. I guess I wonder, is there a relationship between the country's poverty and, you know, its associated political mismanagement that you're describing and terrorism? I mean, is that a clear general relationship in economic terms more generally, or is this a more contingent fact? I mean, are disgruntled Tajiks likely to have found their way to terrorism at all, absent the sort of proximity to Afghanistan, which obviously has had its own long-running problems with terrorism and violence, etc.?
I mean, we shouldn't exaggerate and generalize from the particularly horrific incident that played out in Moscow. Tajikistan is not in Iraq or Syria in terms of, you know, generating terrorism. It's rather more a victim of backwash from regions like that. It's certainly true, obviously, that a society as desperately poor as Tajikistan is the kind of place that will generate young men willing to sacrifice their lives for, apparently they were paid like $5,000, and this was an attractive offer to somebody in Tajikistan. So that tells you something about the relationship between money and desperation. It's also a state in which there is no possibility of expressing political dissent any other way. The specific currents which have driven resistance, armed resistance, or what I think one undeniably has to call terrorism in Tajikistan are twofold, and they're quite distinct. So one is the movement called Jamaat Ansarullah, which is in some ways the most deeply sworn enemy of the existing Tajiki regime. These are what I call the Tajiki Taliban. They emerge from the discontented groups of the civil war that were not finally pacified and have allied themselves very consistently with the Taliban. The Tajik regime right now gains international legitimacy from the fact that it is the most consistent Central Asian opponent of the Taliban. It essentially swings in its relations to neighboring Afghanistan, depending on where the Taliban in power. But the folks that perpetrated this horrible massacre in Moscow are cut from a different cloth. They are not local or their ideology at least, is not locally generated in on the border between Tajikistan and Afghanistan. They are folks inspired by ISIS's great breakthrough in Syria in 2015, and they're basically affiliated with this ghastly offshoot of ISIS known as ISIS-K. And they are as much opponents of the Taliban as they are of the Tajik regime. They operate out of the same disaffected, chaotic border regions between Tajikistan and Taliban, but they came to the fore in launching a series of attacks in Afghanistan, first against the then Afghan regime and the American forces in 2001, and then subsequently they've struck at the Taliban themselves, they've struck at Iran, and they've struck now against Russia. Why Russia? Because Russia was the big backer of the Syrian regime in the struggle against ISIS, and the Talib are quite closely aligned with Moscow. And so the Russian security forces have said that they've been for some time trying to tamp down and foil these movements. I mean, this is not a giant movement. It's not a large movement the way the Taliban are. The number of ISIS-K fighters in the region are thought to be in the number of 2,000, but they're well-connected, they're ultra-desperate. They do propagandize in Pashto, the Persian-derived lingua franca of the region. So they are a presence, but we shouldn't imagine that somehow they are the dominant force in most of Tajik life. The beef between the Tajiki Taliban and the regime in Tajikistan is much more structurally central to the region than the ISIS-K. ISIS-K will recruit across this far-flung, ultra-radicalized Islamic networks in regions like this because it's facilitated by the poverty and desperation of the young men there.
So I mentioned those large volumes of remittances that flow every year from Russia to Tajikistan in the order of $3 billion, give or take. You know, obviously that shows a real dependence by Tajikistan on Russia. I'm curious whether that dependence also flows in the other direction or to what extent it does. I mean, does Russia depend itself on labor from Tajikistan? And, you know, how does the Russian government acknowledge that, if at all?
Yes, Tajikistan is reckoned to be the most remittance-dependent economy in the world, which again places it in the company of the Haitis and so on. So it's an economy whose major export is people to a considerable extent, cotton, aluminium, and people. Somewhere between 30 to 40% of the Tajik economy is generated by external remittances, and Russia is where they go. And it's important, I think, to correct a kind of preconception that folks may have about Russia. One thinks of it perhaps as a sort of ethnically homogenous, you know, white country and nation. And there certainly is a powerful Russian nationalism that likes to depict itself that way. But in fact, it's one of the great migrant nations of the world. It has, depending on how you count it, the fourth or fifth largest migrant population in the world. And the Russian data on this are not very good. Estimates vary between 10 and maybe as many as 25 to 30 million migrants living more or less formally or informally in Russia. And in a city like Moscow, this implies that, you know, out of its mighty population of 13 million people, a very substantial fraction are non-native born. And in that group, so it's estimated that there are about a million Tajiks on the official numbers in Russia, and about half of those are in Moscow. So, you know, at a casual estimate, maybe 5% of the population of Moscow might be Tajik, allowing for undercounting, and so 1 in 20. And then previously, the biggest migrant group was Ukrainian. They've tended to go home. And so Tajiks have emerged in recent years as the largest group of migrants to Russia. They're heavily concentrated in all of the sectors that you'd expect, notably the construction sector in Moscow. And the Russia has a kind of split attitude. On the one hand, the cultural nationalism, you know, voiced so vociferously and toxically by the mouthpieces of the Putin regime in media, continuously encourage a demand for deportation and exclusion. According to independent pollsters, the Levada Center, who are generally the people that we draw on to get data on the Russian public opinion, in 2021,
the share of Russians favoring restrictions on further migration was as high as 68%, and 26% of Russians favored banning all migration from Central Asia altogether, because Central Asians are a very prominent part of Russian urban life at this point. And so anti-Central Asian racism expresses itself quite manifestly. And those attitudes have become more pronounced since the Russian attack on Ukraine and the heating up of Russian nationalism. But what's been very striking about Putin's response to the attacks is that he has not chosen to nationally politicize this in that way. I mean, one of his key lines was, you know, terrorists have no nation. So it's quite clear, I think, that Moscow recognizes officially, the official mind, there's a clear understanding of Russia's need for migrant labor. Why? Because the Russian population is declining. It's currently 145 million and falling fast. If it's to maintain the 145 million level, Russia needs to absorb perhaps between 500,000 and 1 million migrants a year, every year. And so Russia really cannot afford to antagonize one of the great labor pools of Central Asia, and one which geopolitically and diplomatically is closely aligned with Moscow.
I mean, I'm just curious, are there efforts made to integrate these migrants into the Russian society, or do they sort of inevitably remain on the margins, or, you know, do they eventually become Russian citizens? I find that somehow, I don't know, hard to imagine, but do you have any sense of that?
No, there are naturalization programs, but I mean, like most societies, and you can hardly single out Russia for this, Russia struggles to formulate a coherent approach to this question. And this is striking only given the significance of its reliance on migrant labor. But if you think about Western Europe's attitudes on this, attitudes of the United States, like all other large societies with powerful ethno-nationalist streaks, Russia has found it very difficult to formulate a coherent program. But no, you can apply for naturalization. I mean, after all, Russia is the rump of a giant multi-ethnic empire that was organized around an assertion of a common citizenship within the Soviet Union, in which then ethnic categorizations and cultural identities could be asserted as a secondary marker. But the Russian state historically has certainly been capable of expansive notions of inclusion, though not particularly, you know, very well endowed notions of citizenship. But you can indeed acquire a Russian passport.
So I guess speaking about, you know, large empires, Tajikistan is also a former part of the broader Persian Empire. As you mentioned, it's a Persian-speaking country, one of only three majority Persian-speaking countries, I think, alongside Iran and Afghanistan. And I'm curious whether those historical and cultural ties to Iran find any kind of expression in economic ties today. I mean, what is the relationship between Tajikistan and, yeah, the Persian hegemon of Iran?
No, it's really a fascinating question. And Iran was the first country in the world to formally extend diplomatic recognition to Tajikistan in 1991. And the revival of Persian culture and language in Tajikistan in the 1990s was heavily backed by Iran. There remain, however, quite fundamental differences, notably to do with religion, because Tajikistan is Sunni and Iran is Shia. The regime in Tajikistan is secular, and the regime, obviously, in Iran is profoundly committed to the Islamic revolution of their vision. And they're separated by the other Central Asian republics, so there isn't a land bridge connection. So economic trade is not very large, it's not very significant, but there are moves, and they're really dictated by a super complex configuration of geopolitical concerns. So in the 2010s, relations between the Iranians and the Tajiks fell to a low ebb after the Tajiks failed to hand back to Iran the billions squirreled away by a particularly corrupt Iranian oligarch who was playing the sanctions game to his personal advantage. The Iranians then responded to this lack of cooperation from the Tajik side by playing hosts to one of the few remaining opposition figures in Tajik politics. That then opened the door to the Saudis, who saw an opportunity to outflank the Iranians in their own, you know, in their own region of influence. But then things began to escalate because Iran was put under massive pressure by the Trump administration from 2018 onwards, and Iranian foreign policy shifted very dramatically towards trying to build connections towards the East. Turkey became more and more powerful and was backing Uzbekistan, amongst other things, supplying Uzbekistan with drones, which makes the Tajiks feel uncomfortable. Then you have the collapse of American power in Afghanistan, which makes everyone in the region feel uncomfortable because they have to deal with the Talib. And then in 2022, Russia invades Ukraine. And so Russia, which serves as an important ally to both Iran and Tajikistan, is distracted. And so in this kaleidoscope, Iranian and Tajik relations pivot back and forth depending on the forces at work. And right now, they've all clicked into cooperation mode. So the distraction of the Russians, the aggression of the Americans, the chaos in Afghanistan and the Talib coming to power flipped Tajikistan and Iran into a more cooperative mode. So the Iranians have built the Tajiks a drone plant. They're talking about investments. They're talking about various Iranian Tajik plans to open up another one of these land bridges, which the Russians, the Iranians, the Indians have periodically been working on and trying to build connections, their version of a kind of north-south, one belt, one road. All of those are in kind of on mode right now. It's like a combination lock and everything has clicked into place. How far it really goes, given the limited resources of both sides, I think is an open question, and whether it might not just flick back into another position, depending on forces acting on both of them from the outside. But they are indeed a kind of hinterland of Iranian power and influence, which competes and overlaps the Russian zone and the other zones of influence which are operating in this zone. So Russian, Iranian, Saudi, or it's this new great game, you might say, in which Tajikistan is a very fragile and poor player.
Fascinating stuff, you know. Yeah, a very poor country, but when you take a look at it, obviously it is densely tied into this broader geopolitical game that we're always talking about. But yeah, we do need to leave the conversation off here for now, but we will be back as always next week. See you then. Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy Readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code Twos at checkout. That's T-O-O-Z-E. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.
The first teller of my story is me.
This week on Disorder.
In this new world, when military power will be connected with high tech, small states can be very, very powerful.
Could small states help order the world?
Small states could be as effective, as dangerous as the big ones.
To find out, we're joined by Dr. Armen Sarkisian, Armenia's former president and prime minister.
In our two-part series, we discuss the history of the Armenian genocide,
the ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh,
and why small states could be the answer to the disorder in our world.
The big powers today have to compete in order to attract the small states to be their allies.
You can get Disorder wherever you get your podcasts, or you can follow the link in the show notes.